Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. The number is 1-800-638-7781. If you are a first or second-time home buyer looking for a home in the city of Baltimore, 1-800-638-7781, the Maryland Mortgage Program is a place to go. We are joined by Dario De Battista, who is an author of the memoir Go Now, You Are Forgiven, and the forthcoming novel, The Contagion. He's an Iraq War veteran, did two tours. His website will be linked on our website. It's dariodibattista.com. It's one of our Urbanite Radio stories. My dear friend Rafael Alvarez, in this month's Urbanite, did a story writing about Iraq, his story. He now teaches at the Community College of Baltimore County, and he's a writer and an Iraq War veteran. And Dario, welcome. Good to have you in the studio, man.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I really appreciate being here. I should mention respectfully, I'm still looking for a publisher for my memoir. So if anybody's listening, who knows anybody, and takes any sad, pathetic interest in me, please let me know.
So you did two tours.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Almost a third, I read.
Yep. The third would have been in Fallujah, Iraq, with Civil Affairs Unit back in 2006.
And, you were, when 9/11 happened, you were already in, boot camp. Is that right?
I had just graduated boot camp, August 24th, 2001.
Wow.
And I was at Marine combat training when that happened.
So you know where you were headed to?
Pretty much.
So there's no question.
It's this weird kind of conundrum too. You know, people, it means a lot. It really does. Everybody's like, thank you very much for your service. You know, would I have joined the Marines after 9/11? I don't know. I can't honestly say. But because I had already been in the service, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, let's go. I'm ready.
So now tell me why you joined the Marines in the first place. What was it that drew you to the Marines? I didn't mean like, why are you a Marine? I mean,
yeah.
No, but why did you choose to join the Marines in the first place as a young man?
I was just a very, I lacked any sort of motivation. I didn't really care about school. I think my guidance counselor told me I had the lowest GPA possible to graduate. I just didn't really have a lot of motivation. I didn't have a lot of discipline. You know, I was looking in the future. It's like, all right, what am I going to do? I'm going to go to community college and live in my parents' basement. And what would be the point of that? I'd go to school and be like, oh, I don't have to be here. And then I'd not go anymore.
So something happened in your two tours in Iraq that kind of brought you to this world of wanting to be a writer.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always been your prototypical right-brained individual. I like drawing, photography. Everybody had already said you were good at writing, but it was not something I really wanted to do. In the Urbanite piece, it talks about how I wanted to live in a van and eat bean burritos and play,
right,
you know, crappy indie rock. But basically, I just came back and, you know, I know now, for all the education that I've gotten in the years later, that I had all the classic symptoms of combat stress, survivor's guilt, post-traumatic stress, whatever you want to call it. I was, you know, not sleeping well. I was very wound up. You know, there's a lot of different issues, self-medication. I was drinking a lot, just basically to numb my brain, just deal with everything that had happened. I'd be prone to aggression, very nervous in crowds. All the signature symptoms,
right,
were there. So I just started writing. Originally, it was because, to be honest, I was coming back from and I had been going through a really bad relationship, and the other person in the relationship had a blog, and they started saying stuff about me. That was, right, it was very like nondescript, you know. It wasn't like, it was particularly my name, but I was like, oh, I know you're writing about me. So my revenge, you know, being a 21-year-old, just coming home from the second tour, it was like, oh, I'm going to start my own blog. But I just started writing, and people kept saying, hey, man, this is pretty good stuff. I like your viewpoint. You know, you should keep with that. And I did.
Just to give a sense, we were talking about maybe reading something. You have you want to read one of the poems? We had talked about a couple of them. What would you like to?
Sure. This one is about suicide. It's called Checking Out. There are 8 steps that make up the cycle of operations for firing a closed chamber weapon. Cocking, feeding, chambering, locking, firing, unlocking, extracting, ejecting. But I only need one motion to blow these nightmares right out of my head. I'm choking the pistol in my palm, a trigger pull, bring back that finger, drop the hammer, and let it ride. The Navy head shrink said yesterday at our meeting that suicidal people are hopeless. They're selfish, and they feel no reprieve from reality. I can't believe that is true. I think of this as alternative medicine. My bullet's a magic lead pill, better than Xanax, Coke, or booze. It's easy to take. Just inject it into your swollen skull. There's no cure for the image of the bomber's corpse exploding, shrapnel slicing my men, body parts tossed, a string of his intestines wrapped around the captain's neck, and the bomber's head popped off like a champagne cork that landed on my chest. After getting knocked down, I cut my elbow on the rocky sand, but I was fine. Five of my guys died, but I was fine. This war's not done, but I'm done with it. Hear bullet, silence my brain.
And that's a very powerful piece. And it speaks to, I don't know if it speaks to you, Dario, maybe it does on some levels when you came home, but it speaks to a lot of men.
Yeah.
Where that actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
Women, I should say now.
Thank God I had a really good support system when I came back, and I definitely was suicidal, but I never really acted on it. It did come somewhat close one time, but more often than not, I had a good group of friends. Even when I was acting crazy, had a lot of stuff going on, they'd pull me aside and be like, hey man, what's going on? I didn't want to let any of them down. I came back. I was still in the service. You know, I had risen up through the ranks a little bit. I had people that depended on me, so I wanted to, you know, do my best and do what I had to do.
What rank did you come home as?
Oh, I was a Lance Corporal, but eventually I became a Corporal. I was in the reserves. They tend to promote a little bit slower than the active duty side.
Right.
But even though I was a Lance Corporal, you know, you got a combat action ribbon. You did two tours. You get a little bit of respect.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that we had someone on the show here just recently, Paul Chappelle. I don't know if you know him. He's another.
I listened to that podcast.
Okay. So interesting writer and an interesting thinker.
Yes.
A very deep thinker, I think. One of the things he said on the program was that, it made me think about when you said you felt suicidal when you came home, what happens to a lot of people when they come home from war. And he said, you know, we always think of war as natural part of human, natural part of humanness. But it was so natural, we wouldn't be coming home like this.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. It's the antithesis of the American experience. I mean, here in the U.S., we complain when we get stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic. A bad day in the U.S. is, oh, the printer's not working, and I can't get this to the boss right away. In Iraq, a bad day is your friend just died. You know, somebody in the unit got hit. One of your periphery friends, who is in the same unit as you, lost their legs. You know, something scary like that. It really kind of distorts stuff. And when you're in the service, you know, people have this cliche that the military is a bunch of killers, a bunch of wild men. I worked in the profession of death, but I've never met a killer. I've met professionals. And that's a big part of the problem. You do it as a profession, and it's when you come back that you stop and really digest and think about all the things that you had done as a reaction. They train you to do this, even at boot camp. You're shooting at a human-shaped target from 500 yards away. That's so when you do go into combat, you get used to looking down your iron sights and what that would look like.
And that's what you said about describing what it is. I mean, because people do kind of often think of, especially men, but now men and women in combat.
Yeah.
As killers, but it's so, as we've had many other shows with vets, this is it's not reality. Reality is staying alive and taking care of folks around you.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I was telling my students just the other day through my research, you know, and I do all this stuff about PTSD, coming home challenges, all that stuff. When Saving Private Ryan came out,
yeah,
there was a huge uptick in World War II veterans who went to seek treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. Because they had never processed those experiences. They came home. They were the generation that was quiet.
Right.
They didn't share their story. They didn't talk. And even that, many years later, just being reminded of it so vividly impacted them in that really powerful way.
So, and one of your ways, obviously, is your writing.
Yeah. For me, it definitely got me to where I needed to be.
And your teaching. How's your teaching play into that? Because you're teaching writing right now at the Baltimore County Community College.
Yeah, it's freshman composition. It's nothing glorious.
But you're teaching, which is cool.
It is. It's very cool.
Do you like it?
I love it.
All right. So, but is that part of all this for you? I mean, how do you translate your being a writer? I know you're looking for your publisher for you. That's the thing, you'll find it. Yeah. But how do you translate your being a writer into this class? And what does it, what you bring back from the war and your writing have to do with how you teach?
It's really interesting. I'm still going by the seat of my pants. I just finished my second semester. The first semester.
You just began teaching.
I'm not a noob. I did get 1 year down. But I still have a lot to learn, and I think anybody who's taught will say there's a big learning curve for a while. But the first semester, I had these lofty expectations. I was like, all right, we're going to read The Road by Cormac McCarthy, this really heartbreaking post-apocalyptic novel. And I was like, students are going to be so moved by it, it's just going to change their perspective on everything. They weren't interested. They didn't care. They couldn't get behind it. This semester, I taught a friend of mine, Kelly Kennedy, USA Today reporter who was embedded in Baghdad. She wrote a book called They Fought for Each Other. And my thinking was, even though this is something maybe a lot of you guys don't know about, because the military population only represents 1% of the U.S. population, this is real. And this is what people your age are doing and going through. And even if you don't have an opinion about it, you will after you read this stuff. And she was very gracious, and she came and she spoke to my class. So it was a really neat experience for them, I think.
So when you write, I mean, you write as much for yourself as you write for those who are going to read what you do?
Yeah. If I didn't believe in what I was doing, I would have stopped a long time ago. I tell people becoming a writer is infinitely harder than anything I did. That includes being in Iraq. It's a very, 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 very tough profession. And there's a lot of stresses, a lot of heartache, a lot of beating your head against the wall and trying to get people to listen.
So, but you wrote about your rejections.
I have not yet.
It was on your site, or was that in the article?
I probably have in like a personal blog or
right.
Facebook.
It was on your blog when you were talking about writing.
Yeah, but I found, whether I like it or not, just where I am, being somebody who was able to go to war twice and come back and get educated, I'm a beacon in the community. There's a lot of veterans who can look to me and say, okay, here's somebody who's been through a lot of hardships, been through a lot of struggles and risen above it, and maybe my story can impact them in some way, a positive way. That's what I'm hoping. You see a lot of the, oh, my life is ruined because I had PTSD, but you don't see a lot of, hey, man, I went to war and I did some messed up stuff and I saw some messed up things, but now I'm back and I'm better.
You said another friend of mine was on the show recently. We had a conversation about post-traumatic stress, and the comment was made during the show that one person that was saying that I don't use the word PTSD anymore, post-traumatic stress disorder. I just say post-traumatic stress because it's not a disorder.
No, it's not. And it's an interesting note. Our society is, we get all sorts of different medical labels for everything we do. I know people, students, who say, oh, I can't pay attention in class. I have attention deficit disorder. In some ways, there's a big debate, but if we say to somebody, hey, man, you have PTSD, it almost gives them less of an incentive to try and fix themselves because they have a legitimate disorder and there may not be anything they can do about that. They can take the pills that silence or numb the emotions, but maybe that's just a stop loss. At some point, you got to face your memory. That's what we do with the Veterans Writing Project that I work for. And I'll be teaching at Walter Reed here soon.
You'll be teaching there?
Yeah.
Good.
Our practice, we've got a very generous grant for, is, hey, here's your memory. You got to take possession of it. This is the only way you're going to be able to rise above what you did. Either you own your story or it owns you.
So there's another poem I'd like you to read, if you would. And by the way, again, to remind folks who are just tuning in or didn't hear the very top of the half hour, we're talking with Dario Di Battista doing one of our – did I say your last name right?
Yeah.
Yep. And who is one of the Urbanite Radio stories. Rafael Alvarez wrote a piece on him. He's working on his memoir, Go Now, You Are Forgiven, and a novel, The Contagion. He served 2 tours of duty in Iraq. We'll be linking to his website on our website, DarioBautista.com, and teaches at Community College in Baltimore County and now in the writer's program at Walter Reed. You wrote the piece, Body Bags. Could you read that?
Unfortunately, that one's online only, and I don't have access to the web.
If I could pull it up?
Sure.
Let me see if I have it right here. I thought I do have it here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I do have it here. So I think that one of the things that strikes me, I think, is important about your work, it reminds me of a program series we did actually 6 years ago now. It was that long.
Wow.
When we went to Vietnam in 2005, a lot of vets, and did these stories over a period of time, 6 weeks in Vietnam, between soldiers on both sides, and telling their stories. And most of them had become, and these were writers and artists who had been in combat during Vietnam. And it was trying to bring the reality, without being ugly about it, to what people went through, to understand. And to me, when I read Body Bags, that's what struck me. It was just something so real that you were able to share that gives people a sense of what it means to be who you are and were. So that's why.
Sure, I'd be happy to read that. Yeah. I should mention that this one was actually inspired by Kelly Kennedy's book, They Fought for Each Other. There was a story about the unit who had been, they were just in a huge IED. Dozens of soldiers died. They were the hardest hit unit in Iraq. And I was just so moved by it that I decided to write that. So here it is, Body Bags. How am I to decide whose parts are whose? The mortuary remains will need to piece together the remains, and what's never recovered will be shaded black on their paperwork. But there are so many parts, and I can't tell who's Taliban, or civilian, or a brother I loved. I pick up the blackened fingers in the gasoline mud, and the pieces of the charbroiled carcass that don't crumble when I lift them. I grab the thighless legs, boots still attached, and the jawbone. I hold the body bag over my shoulder, unimpressed by the weight of what remains of mighty men.
And when you walk home with that, I mean, people, the reason I think it's so important is I think people, especially these generations who have never kind of really experienced anything like this in America in 40 years, I mean, there was the first Gulf War, but I shouldn't say but, and there was the first Gulf War.
Yeah.
But for people to kind of feel those words, you can at least get a sense of what men and women went through who had to go through it.
Mm-hmm. But all my favorite artists were the ones who were not afraid to go to the dark place. There's nothing poppy or comforting about that, but it's real. And it's an experience, I never had to experience anything that visceral. There's a lot of people who have done stuff like that. And you see these stories on the news, and it's just suicide bomber kills 15. It's the headline. You don't even click on it anymore because you've already read the story dozens of times. But when you see that or you hear that, it becomes more powerful. I think about the photo, the Pulitzer Prize-winning photo of the little Afghani girl in the green dress. I don't know if you saw it or not. And there's all these bodies around her and people are dying and she just has this look of sheer terror on her face. And that's the one that registers. The news kind of just has a very antiseptic revealing of things at this point. And maybe that's just because the story's been going and people are just frustrated. Why are we here? Why is this going on? What can we do about it? Even people who wanted things to change, they haven't changed. We still got wars going on.
There's a story that you talked to Rafael Alvarez about in the piece for The Urbanite, about the friend of yours who you convinced to come and join the Marines who was killed.
Yeah.
That was a very moving piece. I mean, I can see you had a little humor in it because you had a little dark humor in you anyway.
Yeah. But I do.
You do. Bit. So, but
workplace hazard. You gotta develop something of a dark humor.
Yeah, right. So, could you mind talking about that?
That story was probably the scariest thing I've ever wrote in my entire life. As a writer, you have to get to a place where you're comfortable revealing your soul. And as a mandate of memoir, good memoir, is you kind of got to make yourself look like a jerk too.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it doesn't really work.
Right.
People are like, why am I reading this guy? That's what we like about it. That's why reality TV is so popular. We want to see people's dark side. But this story didn't involve me. It did, but I really wanted it to be their stories. And Norm was a just amazing young man who he was going to join anyway. His father was in the Army. But I really felt compelled to try to get him to join the Marines to make that change. And I've wondered years afterwards, maybe if he had joined the Army, things would have been different. He wouldn't have been in the Marines. The Marines are typically in the hot spots, first to fight, you know, all those things. They're cliches, but they're mm-hmm. true in a lot of places. If you look at how many Marines were killed in Anbar versus how many soldiers were killed in Baghdad, the numbers are pretty much the same, even though the Marines are only about a fifth the size of the army.
And this, and you became friends with his wife. Well, not friends, but you...
Yeah, it was... I mean, you can't make it up. You know, sometimes the truth really is stranger than fiction. I met her at a bar when she was grieving her husband's loss. And
Not knowing it was she.
I had never met her before.
Right,
the bartender just knew I had been in the service. And he's like, hey, man, this young woman just had her husband killed in Iraq. Can you talk to her? And I did.
It turned out to be his wife.
Yeah. And then we kept in touch for a while. You know, she lived in the area, and she'd come to my workplace. I was working at a restaurant at the time. And then news of her husband's best friend, who was another guy who had been in the recruiting office when I was there, and him being killed, that was too much. You know, at some point, you get over trauma, but sometimes you don't really want to face it anymore. You know, I have some friends who passed away, and I've never visited their graves. You know, I made peace with their death, but sometimes you don't want to see it right in your face, you know.
So when you write, and I have only read little pieces of what you've written on your website and other than that, and some of your poetry, can you write the lightness as well as the dark?
You'd have to clarify that question for me.
Sure.
A little bit confused.
Okay. So I can do that. I mean, because you said, you know, we talked about Cormac McCarthy and the places you like to go and the kind of writing you like to do. And I think a lot of us kind of can go to the Cormac McCarthy side because, you know, not that it's easy to do, but we can go there. The question is that they can't.
I've got a bunch of Pulitzer Prize writing novels ready to go. No, I'm just teasing. I'm joking.
He's a great writer.
He is.
Amazing writer.
Top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so what I'm saying is there, I mean, the stuff I've read that you've written, a lot of it comes out of war. And what about the other part of that, the lightness that happens in war, too, the lightness that kind of happens with other men you're with or what happens in a place you might be? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, it's an interesting note because the other officer you just had on recently, he was talking about people are not. Conflict is not in the nature of mankind, but if you look to literature, if you don't have conflict, you don't have a story. And that's every story that's ever been told. So it's a good place to start, I think, obviously. You know, and if I wrote a story about... Well, I'm deviating from your question, and I apologize.
No, that's cool.
I think my story is one of hope. There's a lot of darkness in there.
Right, right.
But at the end, it's, you know, it's maybe a path some people... Somebody can follow. Somebody can follow my downward spiral and then see this is what happened. This is the lesson learned. These were the lessons learned, and these are some ways that they might take corrective action.
Because I feel it from you, and I can see it in the little things you read, that your writing is about this place that happens, this kind of dark spot, but it also has to do with the kind of what opens up.
Yeah.
And you're opening up.
Yeah. And that's what I want to continue to do. People, there's so many cliches about post-traumatic stress. Something bad happened.
Yeah.
And now somebody screwed up. That's how you always see it in Hollywood. It's always, oh, this guy got upset because he saw his buddy but could die, and now he's going to come home and beat his wife. You know, they're insulting.
Yes.
Post-traumatic stress disorder, what we know of it is sometimes you just, your head is like a reservoir, and at some point it fills up. For everybody, that gauge is different. The amount of trauma you can take is different depending on the person. But at some point, no matter who you are, no matter how tough you are, every person who's exposed to things that are traumatic will be affected in a very profound way.
We have to wrap it up now, but your novel, Contagion, is that about the war as well?
The Contagion it's the whole story is a metaphor of post-traumatic stress disorder. The same way Blackness by Jose Saramago or The Plague by Camus. It's a story about these afflictions, but they're also on a deeper level. So it's about a biological attack, but that's what it's really about.
Dario Di Battista, it's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you
for coming in the studio. Pardon me.
No worries.
Good to meet you through The Urban Night, one of our Urban Night Radio stories. The memoir he's trying to get published now, which we're looking forward to, Go Now, You're Forgiven. The Contagion is his novel. Two tours in Iraq, teaching now as well as writing. And you can go to dariodibattista.com. That'll be on our website.
Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Good to have
you. Wish I had a simpler name.
That's a great name. Good name, man. Good name. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Cricket Harrison and Justin Levy. Our assistant producer is Cassandra Monsanto. Our interns are Alexis Seth, Alex Pearson, and Tiffany Means. We're engineered by Regis Tucker. Our theme music is by Will Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and connect to our guests and their work, please visit us on the web at SteinerShow.org. We're public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.